All right, we call meeting to order. Did everybody get a chance to review the minutes, and do I have a motion to approve the minutes? Mm-hmm. Second. Mm-hmm. All in favor? I think let's take a second since we have some new folks and people we haven't introduced ourselves to, and we've got a speaker today. Just go around and introduce ourselves and what position that we hold on the council. Bob, why don't you start? Since you're, we'll go around. Your mouth is full.
Your mouth is full.
I'm still eating. So.
I tonight represent the law enforcement council, so I'm going to lead you from that.
I'm Dave Fuller. I represent Clark Regional Emergency Services Agency.
John Roth. I represent the Clark County Water Utility, Clark PUD.
Mark Collier, representing separate designers, installers, and maintenance people. Remy Houston, representing the dental community.
Hi, I'm Joe Cayley. I'm a community health nurse, but I'm here on the council. I'm a non-elected representative from the city of Vancouver.
I'm Charlotte O'Board. I'm an educational community representative, the principal of Abner High School.
Marla Sanger, and I'm a consumer of public health services.
John Harbison. I'm the administrative services director of the Clark County Public Health.
Paul Childers, and I represent the restaurants of Clark County.
Paul Miller, I'm public health officer.
I'm Ruth
Armstrong.
I'm the communications director.
Cindy
Brown, and I represent the consumers of public health services.
David Hudson, Public Communities Program Manager, Public Health.
Janice Koch, I'm the Environmental Health Director for Public Health.
Brian Schlotten, Program Manager, Environmental Public Health.
I'm Adrienne Fairbanks, I'm a veterinarian practicing in Clark County.
I'm Roxanne Wolf, I'm the Director of Community Health and Safety for Public Health. And I'm Lydia Gurman, Administrative Assistant for at Clark County Public Health.
And I'm Kate Budd. I serve as the executive director with the Council for the Homeless. Awesome. Okay, and I don't think we have any public comments since there's no public. So that we get to move on to Kate. Thanks for being here tonight. We're looking forward to the presentation. Great. Well, thank you all for having me this evening. I would come simply just for the meal. So this is icing on the cake. I have had the pleasure of serving as the executive director with the Council for the Homeless for the last year and a half. Before then, I served as the deputy director with the agency and then worked with Clark County Department of Community Services 7 years prior to that. I've spent my entire career focused on serving people that are experiencing homelessness, working in shelters, working in different housing programs, working in volunteerism and civic engagement to help people who are low income and experiencing homelessness make sure that their voices are heard. And I'm also someone who has experienced homelessness. As a youth, I had been disowned by my family and left with basically the clothing on my back. Went to college as a sophomore in Eastern Oregon and lived out of my car for almost 6 months. And so I have the kind of undistinguished lived experience that many here in Clark County and across Washington State have, and worked very hard to utilize that lived experience to make a difference here in our community and to make sure that we are focused on reducing homelessness throughout the county. So regarding the Council for the Homeless, we are a local 501c3 agency. Our mission is to prevent and end homelessness throughout Clark County by providing leadership, advocacy, and solutions. And so when I talk about those three focus areas, we are the planning and coordinating body around homelessness in Clark County. What that means is we every few years create a homeless action plan, which provides the path for those entities that are publicly funded as well as privately funded entities to follow in order to work to reduce homelessness. We just updated our homeless action plan, and it was adopted by the Clark County Council in November of 2018. And so I encourage you, if you're interested, the final document is on our website. And it's a very informative document. We have, folks have described it as kind of housing ease on some level where, you know, there's a lot of information and there are some details that may be a bit jargony, but also the document's been described as really revealing and informational. And folks like to know, you know, what is happening in the community and what is the path that we're charting forward. We also work very hard to increase the level of understanding regarding our homeless crisis response system. We know that the number of people experiencing homelessness that are visually apparent throughout the county is continuing to increase. And so when people rightfully ask, what is being done, we want to help to provide that answer. One way that we help is that we have the administrative duties of the Homeless Management Information System. And so this is a database that all of the homeless crisis response service providers, so not only does Janus Youth, which serves youth, and SHARE use that database, but also Open House Ministries and the Salvation Army, which have primarily privately funded programs, they use the Homeless Management Information System. And so the great thing is that we have a wealth of information that helps us be able to understand what the need in the community is, as well as how are we meeting the need through our various programs. And so we use that database to be able to educate the community around homelessness and how we are doing to progress our priorities and identified outcomes. We also do quite a bit of convening and collaboration. One key way that we do that is to address the additional housing needs that come up during the winter. As you know, it can get incredibly cold, snowy, icy in this area, and it can truly be life-threatening for people who are living outside. And so we are fortunate to be a partner in the WHO efforts, which stands for Winter Hospitality Overflow. There are two Lutheran churches that open up, one in downtown and one over in Orchards, and they increase our shelter bed capacity by an additional, we're up to 76 people now, which is incredible. And we have churches throughout the county that also open up when we're in severe weather, which is something that the Council for the Homeless calls when the temperature is below 32 degrees, or there's snow or freezing rain in the forecast. And so we have four churches right now that may open up when we're in severe weather and could increase our shelter bed capacity by an additional 400 beds, which is amazing. And unfortunately, when they open, they're often primarily full, which means that need exists here in the community. We do a great deal of advocacy at all levels of government. We were really pleased to be a part of this last legislative session at the state level, where we saw some really strong wins for tenants. We also saw some increases in funding, not only for the Housing Trust Fund, which fuels affordable housing development, but also for the HEN program, which stands for Housing and Essential Needs, which is through SHARE. And serves people who have disabilities but haven't been able to achieve Social Security yet. So it's for those who are most vulnerable. We hope to see additional dollars coming into the community as a result of that. Lastly, we provide a number of solutions in the community. What I think we're most well known for is that we run the Housing Solutions Center, and that is the hub for anyone that's experiencing homelessness to call or access through one of the street outreach teams if they're looking for any type of shelter space or they're looking for a longer-term housing program. We also connect people with a number of prevention programs. And what that means is if someone is doubled up or couch surfing, maybe staying with family or friends, or they're renting and they're having a hard time paying their rent, then we can help them move into a new stable housing situation or be able to pay their rent so that they don't get evicted and need to leave their home. And so we have that bi-level focus of we want to try to prevent homelessness when we can so that people don't experience the trauma of being without a home. And when someone is without a home, we want to move them into housing as soon as we can. We work with 12 different housing agencies in the community to place people into their different housing programs. And so we very much work as that hub component so that people don't have to go from agency to agency to agency to apply for each of their programs and then kind of wait to see what shakes out. So here's a little bit more about our Housing Solutions Center. This is a picture of our front door. The primary way for someone to access the Solution Center is through our phone number, which is right here. We're open 5 days a week from 9 to 5, and then also on the weekends from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. The hours do expand during the winter, but folks are welcome to call. And if you meet someone and, you know, just say, have you talked to anyone at the Housing Solution Center? Have you sought resources? And they say no. I absolutely encourage you to have them call because we don't know yet if they're on a path to some type of a housing program or shelter. We also have incredible partners that are in the Housing Solutions Center, folks from WorkSource that help connect people with both the soft skill programs and the hard skill programs for employment. We have a staff member from the YWCA that comes on a weekly basis. Not only to help support my staff with the number of folks who are fleeing domestic violence, but also to work with those that come to the Housing Solutions Center to make sure that they have a safety plan in place and are safe from their abuser. We also have someone who comes from the Area Agency on Aging to our office. And what's exciting about that is there's a lot of people that are experiencing homelessness that really should be in an assisted living facility. They have high enough needs where they're struggling to take care of their activities of daily living and have found themselves with no options and are on the street. And so having the AAA there allows us to have them assessed and on the track to an assisted living facility if that's appropriate. So here's a picture of what I like to describe coordinated entry as. My sisters were synchronized swimmers, so this is also appealing. but back even 4 or 5 years ago, before the Housing Solutions Center existed, folks had to apply to various different housing agencies. And often they applied to anything and everything that they could, regardless of whether it was a good fit for them. There are some people that need long-term permanent programs, and others that really just need to have their move-in costs paid, and then they're good to go. And so what the Housing Solutions Center does is it brings all the partners together in a uniform way so that we can assess those who are experiencing homelessness and place them in to the best fit program within the community. There are definitely not enough housing programs that exist. And so there are definitely people who could have accessed the Housing Solutions Center and not been helped yet. But we do work to connect people as quickly as we can with the different housing options. Here's a picture of all our different housing partners. We are really proud to partner with each of these entities. One newer partner that we have is with the VA. And they have a number of different housing programs for veterans, particularly veterans that have higher needs. And so now what this means is even a veteran can just come to the Housing Solutions Center and we'll connect them with the most appropriate housing program for them. And it keeps things as uniform as possible. I'll also mention Safe Park is a local program that's run by a small nonprofit called Go Connect in the community. And they work with churches throughout Clark County who allow usually 5 to 15 cars to park in their parking lot overnight safely with access to restrooms. And this is a really, you know, it's a common sense program. We know that there are people that are living in their car. In fact, there's an enormous number of people that are living in cars in this community. And what this program allows for folks to do is park somewhere where they know it's okay. And they know that someone isn't going to come and say, you need to move. And they have access to a restroom, which is much better than I had someone say to me, you know, I love this restroom. It's so much better than the 7-Eleven at 2 a.m. Mm-hmm. And that's really understandable. Mm-hmm. So that's a great program, and we place people into that program. If they have a car and they have an opening, we're able to connect them with it.
Do the places have showers for the restrooms?
You know, they don't. No, just restrooms. There are a few churches where you can actually go inside, but the rest are porta potties. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to share that one very important piece of reducing homelessness in this community is that there are many stereotypes and myths that are out there that kind of stop productive conversation and stop the ability to kind of think through how we can create programs that support those that are experiencing homelessness. And so here's an example of a few different myths that I hear often related to homelessness. One, I was able to move myself either out of homelessness or out of poverty, and so it means that other people must be able to. In the reality, especially when it comes to homelessness in Clark County and Washington State and nationally, is that people of color who have experienced generational oppression and systemic racism and numerous challenges that other individuals that are not of color may not have experienced are already dealing with enormous challenges to move out of homelessness or to move out of poverty. And so it's really important to think about that. And my office, for example, we think very specifically about how can we provide very specific services to populations of color so that we can help them receive the services that they need to move out of homelessness. And what that often looks like is connecting them to agencies that are culturally specific. And so, for example, we have a very good partnership with the NAACP. And they work to connect their regular meetings and their resources with those that we work with who identify as African American or Black. And that has made an enormous difference. And we've seen our outcomes increase as a result of that connection. We also have a lot of folks that feel like if someone isn't motivated to access resources in our community, then they should just leave the community. And I hear that often too. And often it's just out of exasperation. But the reality is that in our community, we don't have enough resources for folks. We don't have enough shelter. We don't have enough housing programs. And as a result, if someone, and I should also say that we don't have the ability for people to simply just walk in off the street at any point and access alcohol and drug treatment or mental health treatment. And so it means even if someone were motivated to help move themselves off the street, it doesn't mean that they can access the resources that they need to be able to do that. And so I think that's an important realization is we have an opportunity to increase access for folks so that when they're ready to do something different, we are able to provide them with an open door. So I wanted to share a few stories. The woman on the left here, her name is Luce, and Luce has two children. And Luce had been parking on the streets of Vancouver. Each night she would move from place to place. And one night she had a neighbor come out very, very angry and very, very frustrated because she was newly parking in front of their house. Started knocking on her door at 1 a.m. in her car and yelling and screaming at her. And so she rolled down the window and at that point her English was very broken, so she wasn't able to communicate as well as she could. And just basically was saying to him, peace, peace. And the gentleman just kept yelling and yelling and yelling. And so she drove away in tears, and she ended up going to the police station and turning herself in, is what she said. Mm. And she did that because she said, you know, clearly I'm a criminal. You know, this person felt like I shouldn't be on her street. I clearly did something wrong. You know, I'm just trying to take care of my kids, but I have nowhere to go. And I like sharing that story because so often, you know, we assume that, you know, folks are, you know, making choices to choose things that would have put them on the street. This particular woman was just escaping a domestic violence situation. And she found that being in the car with her children was safer than being with her abuser until that night when someone she didn't know basically did the same thing to her that her abuser had done. And so I think it's important to remember that the people who are experiencing homelessness in our community are as diverse as you and I, and often even more diverse, and that every situation is different, and that we never want to make assumptions related to what got them to where they are, nor do we want to make assumptions about what they need. It's incredibly important that they be the experts in their own life. The woman on the right here is Mildred, and Mildred had been a renter and a proud renter for the last 40 years in Brush Prairie. She had found a heck of a deal with a landlord who rented to her for $600 a month, and it's been $600 for the last 10 years. The landlord passed away, and a new landlord purchased the home she had been living in. And the new landlord clearly had talked to some folks or done some studies and realized that $600 a month was not nearly what he could get for that rental. And so he gave Mildred 2 months' notice, which was more than he needed to give. He only needed to give 20 days. That the rent was going to be going from $600 a month to $1,500 a month. Mildred, on a fixed income, had been receiving Social Security and had been receiving $1,200 a month. And at $600, that was great. She could meet all her needs. At $1,500 a month, she couldn't survive. And so she went to the landlord and she tried to explain the situation. And the landlord said, well, it sounds like you need to move out. And so when Mildred arrived at the Housing Solutions Center in her car after spending the night outside for 2 nights, she told us, you know, more about, you know, how her children, she actually had 2 children that passed away. Her husband had previously passed away, and that she had no one. And so it was really unfortunate. But we're seeing more and more aging seniors that are in situations similar to Mildred's, particularly those with fixed incomes. And I had someone beg me to say, make sure you always say pensions when you're talking about fixed incomes, because even people on pensions are struggling. So I have a question for you. What do you think are the states that have the highest rates of homelessness? You can just shout it out.
California.
New York.
New York? I've got 50 of them.
Florida.
Thank you.
Texas, Washington.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. How about ones with the lowest rates of homelessness?
Who wants to be in North Dakota?
North Dakota. Yeah.
I'm gonna move down south.
Any other ideas?
Utah.
Maine. Thank you. All right. Great guesses. I can see that you have a little bit of knowledge about what's going on. And I'm sorry that this is hard to see, but what I want you to focus on is the darkness. You kind of have an idea of the states, the United States here. But what you can see is here on the left is the hourly wage that's required to afford a 2-bedroom unit. And you can see that the West Coast is very dark. You've got Texas, you've got Colorado, very dark, which equates to more expensive. You've got Illinois, Florida was mentioned. And then you've also got New York, New Hampshire, Vermont, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island up there. And what you'll also see is on this side, the number of people who are experiencing homelessness are within the exact same states. And so there's definitely a correlation between high rent and the number of people that are experiencing homelessness. You also see that kind of in the middle states, with Colorado being the only exception, that's where the fewest number of people experiencing homelessness tend to be. The other thing that's common among the states in the middle is that it's less expensive to rent there. North Dakota, very inexpensive unless you start going to the oil country. And even, I think people are surprised by Texas, but Texas is seeing a significant increase in the rent costs that they have there. And so it's good to see that there's kind of a rhyme to the reason that the entire West Coast is seeing an increase in the number of people who are experiencing homelessness. And what's interesting is it's not dedicated to just the big cities. If you talk to people who are in Clallam County or out in the east side of Washington, they too are seeing an increase in the number of people who are experiencing homelessness, or at least a stagnancy. They're also seeing an increase in the rent costs. And this is out of a report called Out of Reach through the National Low Income Housing Coalition. And it's a really interesting read if you might be interested. It just came out end of last week. This is also something out of that report, and I'm sorry some of it is cut off. But it focuses on Washington State. And what I really wanted to make sure I highlighted is that down on the bottom here, it states that the housing wage, so what someone needs to make an hour if they're working 40 hours a week, is $27.71. And so if you think back to a time when you first started your career, you likely weren't making that, and it probably took you a while to get there, if you're even there at all. What this assumes is that someone should be spending about 30% of their overall income. And we know that a lot of people spend a lot more. Interestingly, in Washington State, over 50% of the renters spend over 50% of their income on rent. And what that means is all of those people are unstable in their housing, because it could just take one situation where they're out of work for a period of time and they too could fall into homelessness if they don't have a strong support system. So another question for you. What's the single biggest driver of the increase in homelessness? And I usually give this one away by the time I get here. Any ideas?
Housing costs?
And employment.
Any other ideas?
Unemployment.
Unemployment. Mm-hmm. Excellent guesses. It is the cost of housing is the number one thing that we equate the increase of homelessness to. In no way are we saying that homelessness isn't related to behavioral health challenges or physical health challenges, but what we see overall that is most common among those who are experiencing homelessness is that they have a lack of income to be able to have stable housing. What's really interesting is that in Washington State, alcohol and drug use, with the exception of opioids, is actually going down. The number of single parents in Washington State also going down. Unemployment is at record lows right now. And the level of educational attainment, that's actually sky high right now. And so some of those things that are typically attributed to homelessness are actually going in the wrong direction if we want to attribute those aspects to the increase in homelessness. So another thing that's happening in our community is we're seeing the vacancy rates continue to remain really low. Does anybody have an idea of what percentage a healthy vacancy rate might be? And I should say, when I'm talking about vacancy rate, it's a rental vacancy rate, which basically means how many units does someone who's looking to rent have at their kind of potential of renting? What is available to them to choose from? Any idea on the percentage?
20.
All right, so A healthy vacancy rate is 7%. So right now, we are in between 3 and 4% as a community. And that has actually gone up significantly from 2 years ago, where we were actually below 1%. And so even at 3 to 4%, it's challenging for people to find a unit to rent if they have no barriers to housing. So if they don't have a criminal background, they don't owe landlords money, they have plenty of income. But then at 3 or 4% vacancy rate, if you have any of those challenges, it's still incredibly difficult to find housing. Where we find the most luck is with ma and pa landlords. So folks who are private rental unit owners who might be willing to be a little flexible. And that's becoming less and less in our community as large conglomerates buy up apartment complexes and homes. Any idea what the average move-in cost might be? So if you've been accepted to a new unit and you want to be able to move in, any idea how much tenants might pay on average?
$1,200.
$1,200? $1,500? $1,300? So just in the last month, my average went from $2,500 to
$3,000.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's related to people that we're working with who are already extraordinarily low income. And what I remember when I was renting, usually it was security deposit and then you were good to go. For those of you that haven't rented in a while, now there's a pretty significant application fee. I've seen up to $75 per person. And then there are paperwork fees, which could be anywhere from $50 to $300. There's cleaning fees, which could be $300 to $1,000, maybe even more. And then security deposits, which could range from very reasonable at $500 all the way up to, I've seen, $5,000. And I share all that because it just illustrates the challenges that people, whether they are without a home or just trying to move to a new home, have. Because saving $3,000 is incredibly difficult, especially if you're living paycheck to paycheck. And so that's one of the greatest gaps that my agency tries to fill with private fundraising, is to help people with move-in costs if they have the income to sustain moving forward. So I recognize, again, this is a little difficult to see, but what I want to illustrate here is the increased costs that of rentals between 2000, basically, what do I have? 2019 to 2014, so the last 5 years. And on average, we've seen an increase of about $400 plus. And that's another piece. We think about Mildred's story again, and while her example was very far stretched, even if her rent went from $600 to $1,000, that likely would have put her in a situation where she couldn't stay. And that's where a lot of people in Clark County are, where, you know, every rent increase, they kind of just sucked it up and didn't buy coffee and, you know, didn't buy their kids the new shoes that they needed. But as they see rents continue to rise, at some point, something's got to give. And what we see is they, you know, they very kindly just move out. They often don't wait to be evicted. And then they move right into their car if they don't have a support system that they can move into. Into their home with, or have dollars that they can borrow. There's a great study through the Journal of Urban Affairs that I like to share, and it basically shows that for every $100 of rent increase within the community, it directly correlates to an increase of homelessness. And we know that a lot of our community is definitely part of the metro area. But the further north and east you go, you start getting into the non-metro area. And we are definitely seeing an increase in the number of people experiencing homelessness in those areas, too. We have a survey that we give to folks, and we ask, what was your last permanent zip code before you experienced homelessness? And what we find is that 71% of those experiencing homelessness give a City of Vancouver zip code. 79% give a Clark County zip code. And so I really like to share that because it illustrates that those experiencing homelessness in our community were our neighbors and remain our neighbors. We don't have a huge number of people that are coming into the community, as some may assume. And we definitely see an increase in the more rural areas of people who were living in the more rural areas and now just don't have a home to live in. So every year, the Council for the Homeless conducts a point in time count, which is a one night snapshot of the number of people that are experiencing homelessness. A point in time count is required at the state level to be done every year during the last week of January. And it's actually a requirement at the federal level to be done every other year during that same January time period. This year, we had more volunteers than ever on the street looking to engage folks with a survey. And then we also held what we call Project Homeless Connect, which is a resource fair for anyone, but particularly those experiencing homelessness, to come and learn about what resources are available and directly access different resources like a housing assessment through my agency or a haircut or foot care through University of Portland Nurses. It's a great event and another great way to be able to count as many people as possible who are experiencing homelessness. And so this one night count found that there were 958 people in Clark County that were experiencing homelessness. Among those, basically about half were unsheltered, and so they were living in a tent, in a car, on the street, in places where people shouldn't be living. And then also people were living in shelters, and so that could be share house, share workers inn, as well as open house ministries, or Janus Youth has a shelter for youth who are under age 18. Among those folks, we found that the number of families in the communities experiencing homelessness went up, the number of veterans went up, and the other populations within those experiencing homelessness also went up. And I would imagine that this isn't a surprise to you, particularly as we see the number of people on the street increase. One thing that I really like to point out is that, and I will say, if you're looking at percentages, we did realize the seniors there on the far right should be 185%. I need to update my slide. But the numbers went up significantly for seniors. And those are seniors age 62 and older. We are even seeing seniors age 70, age 80. It's pretty sad, particularly for my staff and program staff. So to dig a little deeper in that point in time count, a few things that we saw was that almost 50% of the people experiencing homelessness in our community were members of a family. And that's definitely a huge myth buster, because I talk to folks almost every day who really pointedly talk about the single men or even the single women that are experiencing homelessness, and they certainly are, but families too very much are. They're just far less visible. They tend to be in cars or purposely hiding out of the view of people. I also like to share, I mentioned persons of color, and among those that were counted in the point in time count, we found that 23% of the overall 958 people identified as a person of color, which is much more than the average population of Clark County that identifies as people of color. The other thing that is worthwhile to note is that 6% of those who were counted were domestic violence survivors. And that is something, too, that unfortunately just continues to result in homelessness for survivors. And through our work with the YWCA, we definitely have not seen that number decrease in any way. And the Y has reported that they've seen a 10% increase in the number of survivors that leave their home and have to become homeless. Another thing with the point in time count is that not all people are sleeping outside. You know, I mentioned that families tend to be in their cars. And we also have folks who stay in emergency shelters and transitional housing. Transitional housing is time-limited housing for folks who are often connected to some type of resource. So maybe a drug court connection. They have the opportunity to stay in transitional housing. Or it could be that someone's involved in a recovery program, and so they get to stay in transitional housing. And the key is that they have to leave at some point. Another thing that was really interesting with this point in time count is we asked people, you know, what was the main cause of your homelessness? And you can see, you know, lack of income, and lack of affordable housing goes hand in hand, as well as eviction were the top reasons. I often have folks say, well, what about alcohol and behavioral health challenges? And the fact is they were under 15%, definitely. But it wasn't the primary reason that those we surveyed had given. And that we have a high number of people that have physical disabilities and mental health challenges, as well as substance use and intellectual and developmental disabilities. So we have a very diverse array of people that are experiencing homelessness. So when we talk about the scale of homelessness, I mentioned that we don't have nearly enough resources to meet the need that exists. And so we look within our homeless management information system. Last year, throughout the calendar year of 2018, we had 741 families and about 1,800 households without children, so those are single individuals and couples. They requested emergency shelter. And we were able to place only about 37% of those individuals in a shelter. And that includes the nightly winter shelters. And yes?
So this is one point in time, right?
So this is through the full calendar year for 2018.
Okay.
So at any point throughout the year, we were able to house through shelter that 842 households. So another snapshot here through our calendar year is that we also had 600 families and about 1,700 households that said, yeah, I'm interested in getting help to be able to move into stable permanent housing. And among those that had indicated interest, we were only able to help connect about 20% of those folks to longer term housing programs. And so you can see that as a community, we have a much larger need compared to the resources that we can provide. And what we've seen through the data that we have through the Homeless Management Information System is that if someone's able to get into a housing program, and I'll talk a little bit more what those look like, they do well. They exit to permanent housing and they don't come back into the system. We have high percentages for this community. The unfortunate thing is we just don't have enough resources to be able to meet the need. So I wanted to mention how important being a trauma-informed system is for our homeless community. We as a system, so across both publicly and privately funded entities, we have adopted a statement that basically says everyone who's experiencing homelessness has experienced trauma. And so we need to make sure that we serve them in a trauma-informed way. And what that means within my agency, as well as across all our different partners, is that we need to make sure we provide welcoming environments. This little picture here is of a little child in a scooter. And you might notice that this child is a person of color. And I mention this because we had a family with 8 kids come into our Housing Solutions Center. And we had recently changed all the toys that we had so that they were illustrative of the populations that come in to our center. And so we had a diverse array of toys that represented people of color and books and magazines, etc. And the kid beelined for this. And he said, this just looks like me, Mom. Looks just like me. I want it. And so we were glad to be able to give it to him. But that made a huge difference because we knew that that created a welcoming environment for that child. And so we continue to make sure that we are representing diverse communities and in everything that we do within our center. Providing choices is also key. We want to make sure that we give people options when it makes sense. We don't require people to go into shelter. We don't require people to go into a particular shelter or in a particular housing program. We simply give them the choices that are available. And sometimes there's only one choice, but they have a choice to turn it down. And that's really empowering and really important when adopting a trauma-informed approach. We want to make sure that we're not putting unnecessary barriers in front of the people that we work with. And so, for example, the access points for the Housing Solutions Center, not only can you call in or drop in, but you can also go to community partners. We have satellite offices up in North County at the North County Food Bank, East County in Washougal, at the Day Center, at Share House, and we also join our street outreach teams to make sure that people know that we're working to access them as opposed to pushing them to access us. We also work very hard to not re-traumatize people. We know that when you have to tell your story over and over again, it can be really traumatizing. And so one of the strengths of having the Housing Solutions Center is that we ask them to share it once and then we record just within our system what it is that they're sharing so that the next provider they see can get a brief on it and only have to ask, you know, questions that they need above and beyond. And we have really good feedback from our clients on that system. They like not having to repeat things over and over and over again. The other thing that we work really hard to do is to try to create situations where people are able to chart their own course. And so when we're able to add more things to the system so that they have a choice, for example, between a longer-term housing program and just move-in cost assistance, we're able to do that. And that often is empowering, too, because there's a lot of people that don't like to ask for help, just like probably many of those of us in this room. And when they do, they want as little as they need. They don't want too much. And so the more choices we can give to folks, the better. So this is a chart regarding the number of seniors that are experiencing homelessness in Clark County. And blue, so the lower numbers, represent the number of unduplicated seniors, so each individual senior that reached out to the Housing Solutions Center. And you can see that it does continue to increase. The green are the number of calls that were duplicated. So the number of times that a senior called, and we could record 10 calls in that number. But what it illustrates for us is just the level of need. Obviously, if someone hasn't had their need met in a different way, they're going to keep calling us back. And so you can see that that need also continues to grow through that chart. So this is a picture of the homeless crisis response system and the different elements that we have. And so the key elements of a strong system is that we have outreach so that we are actually in the community engaging with those who are experiencing homelessness. We work to keep people in their homes if possible. We shelter them to meet the immediate need. One cool thing that we can offer in the community is we provide police motel vouchers. And so if a police officer comes across someone who seems to be particularly vulnerable, then they can put that individual up in a motel for a night. We get excellent feedback from the police officers for that, because often, you know, they don't have anywhere to bring them, nor do they want to bring them to jail. So this is a great option for them. We also have a number of different housing programs that we employ. And the key difference is just how long they last and how intensive the supports are. When I talk about the homeless crisis response system, one thing to note is we're not the end-all be-all for everything. The fact is that homelessness is exacerbated by a lot of challenges. And so you'll see when we talk about the system, that we don't include behavioral health, that that's its own system, and we work very hard to advocate that they provide services to people experiencing homelessness, and that we meet at that intersectionality that exists as often as possible. And same thing with affordable housing, physical health, as well as self-sufficiency programs, all incredibly important, but not within the purview of the crisis response system. That's above and beyond. So when we talk about public health and we talk about those experiencing homelessness, the key connection is that housing is truly healthcare. My example that I like to give is when someone is receiving inpatient alcohol and drug treatment, for example, if they have gone through the very best treatment ever, have spent months in that treatment, and then are released to the street, the odds of them remaining in recovery is incredibly low. Whereas if they're released to housing, the odds of them remaining in recovery is much higher. And so housing is an integral part of all the social determinants of health to help make sure that they are as effective as possible. And when someone is not housed, those other social determinants of health are far less effective. We see that very often in hospitals. Someone may have surgery, and the fact is that the odds of them being able to adequately heal if they're released to the street is very, very low. And so often we work with the hospitals to be able to provide kind of matching motel voucher nights if that's necessary. So a few things to know about the health effects of homelessness is that even a day on the street actually starts to accelerate aging. And we find that if someone experiences chronic homelessness, and this is just simply that they've been without a home for a year, or have had numerous episodes of homelessness for 3 years, on average, their life expectancy decreases by 23 years. And of course, the longer they're on the street, the lower their life expectancy goes. And that's extraordinarily sad. We have more deaths in this field than I've experienced in other fields, and I think of that, and I know I have healthcare professionals in the room, but it's incredible how many deaths we have of very young people. We also have much higher rates of extreme loneliness, and I thought that was an interesting statistic, but very true. Experiencing homelessness is incredibly isolating. And the sense of shame and the extremely low levels of self-esteem very much exacerbated that feeling of loneliness and that feeling of just not knowing who to trust, because often everyone is just out there for themselves. Cognitive impairments is very common. Unfortunately, part of that is that being assaulted on the street is also common. And so that can lead to cognitive impairments, but also just experiencing those as a result of being on the street. Diabetes. We have a lot of folks that have diabetes before they go on the street, but then their symptoms are greatly exacerbated by being on the street. And unfortunately, we see too many people who lose limbs as a result of that. Cancer and dementia. We also see much higher rates of those for people who are experiencing homelessness. A few of the increased risks when someone is living on the street that has been recorded across the nation include contracting hepatitis A, B, C. There have been some outbreaks in larger communities. The fact is, it's not something that we've experienced here locally. And I will also say that kind of the level of filth that people are living in tend to be less. But part of that reason is that folks have to move around on a regular basis. And so they don't actually have the opportunity to kind of live anywhere for a long period of time. So while they may not contract some of these illnesses, there are other challenges they have to deal with. Tuberculosis, that was more common years ago. Scabies is definitely a reality for people who are living on the street. And then bed bugs, weasels, and other kind of crawly things that of course people get when they're living on the street. When we're talking about either addressing these types of illnesses, or even people who are using drugs and alcohol, the key that we focus on, especially among those folks who are living on the street, is harm reduction. And so how can we work with someone to reduce the harm that they're causing to their body, even just a little bit? We have folks who, you know, will do coaching with folks. Hey, you know, what are you doing now? Can we introduce you to alcohol swabs? And you know, that will help you be more safe. And then there are other folks who are ready to just be done, and we can actually make those connections to recovery resources as well. But we want to make sure that our staff are really well educated in harm reduction among both alcohol and drugs and other healthcare risks. So with public health, the response that is usually recommended is kind of focusing on primary, secondary, and tertiary response. And I imagine you hear about this on this committee often. And what's exciting about the Homeless Crisis Response System is that we very much employ that same approach. And so when we're talking about tertiary responses, you know, folks are already experiencing homelessness. They already have high needs. What we employ most often is an approach called permanent supported housing. And what that is recognizing that people who have very intense alcohol and drug challenges, behavioral health symptoms, physical health issues, are utilizing the greatest percentage of our systems of care. So they're the ones who go to the emergency department on a regular basis, to the jail, are engaged by police regularly, are going in and out of inpatient treatment possibly. And to house them is much less expensive than to have them continue utilizing those systems of care. And it's a program that we employ here within the community, and we've had really positive results. And we've also seen that once someone is housed, no matter what level of crisis they're in, that it allows them to just move out of that trauma state. And when you're in a state of trauma, you're basically in fight, flight, or freeze, which means you're not thinking beyond this current moment. And it's really hard for you to think about what you're gonna do in the next 10 minutes, or the next hour, or the next day. And so by housing folks, it gets them out of that fight, flight, or freeze state and allows them to be able to start thinking like, oh, you know, this life really stinks. I wanna do something different. And so we're finding some good success with permanent supported housing. Secondarily, for prevention, we use an approach called rapid rehousing. And this is something, it's a nationally known evidence-based best practice. And what it does is it moves people from a homelessness situation into stable permanent housing. And it provides wraparound supports to help increase their support systems, to help connect them to the resources that they need, and to help make sure that should there be another crisis, they're able to weather it and not have to lose their home. And so we have a number of rapid rehousing programs in the community that are also doing very well at stabilizing families and individuals. So then lastly, when we talk about primary interventions, prevention is the best way to do that, which means keeping people housed. And so that can be providing rent assistance or helping people who are doubled up or couch surfing move into a stable home. And actually right now in the community, we have more prevention assistance than we have had in years, which is exciting. Both the city of Vancouver and Clark County are providing prevention assistance to keep people from falling out of homelessness. And the way to access those dollars are also through the Housing Solutions Center. So a few of the legislative wins that we celebrated from this last session include huge money for the Housing Trust Fund. And what that does is it provides dollars for the development of affordable housing. And affordable housing is incredibly important. not only to help facilitate people moving from homelessness to stable housing, but also people who are low income. As rents continue to rise, they're not often able to stay in their current unit, so moving to something that's more affordable makes a lot of sense and leads to stabilization. We also have additional dollars that might be realized through the Affordable Housing Fund through a bill called 1406. And what that does is it allows local jurisdictions to hold on to a portion of their sales tax to provide to nonprofit entities for affordable housing. And so this is a huge advocacy opportunity because I know that Clark County, as well as the city of Vancouver, and I also just heard the city of Washougal, are considering utilizing this benefit. And that's really exciting. Whenever we're creating affordable housing, it often requires that numerous funding sources be woven together. And so this just provides greater opportunity for those different kind of weaving threads. So a few things about what's next regarding homelessness in the community. The county, through the Department of Community Services, received additional dollars through the primary funding source, which is called the document recording fees. And they just allocated their dollars out. And the contracts start July 1. And so what's exciting is there are additional street outreach staff that will be in the community. There's also additional rapid rehousing program spots that will be available, which is very exciting. As a system, we continue to implement trauma-informed practices and working to make sure that we're treating those clients and those who are experiencing homelessness with that approach. Focusing on equity is key. You already learned that populations of color as well as the LGBTQ population are disproportionately affected by homelessness. And so it's really important that as a system we work to increase the equity of our programs and serve the LGBTQ population and populations of color as effectively as possible, which means really understanding what their needs are and connecting them with culturally specific agencies like Latino Community Resource Group and NAACP. City of Vancouver is also going to be paying for additional street outreach staff, which is great because that facilitates engagement. And we're also reorganizing our kind of primary coordinating body around homelessness, which we call the continuum of care. And what's exciting about that is we're bringing elected officials from the city, the county, and the housing authority together to have a conversation around the same table with high-level administrators. And it's really the first time that that's occurred in the community on a regular basis. And so you'll have ongoing conversations about outcomes that are being achieved and the needs in the community among our primary funders, which I'm very excited about. It's been a long time coming. The City of Vancouver Affordable Housing Fund, which was Prop 1 that was passed 2 years ago, that continues to increase the amount of affordable housing that's available in the community. They're actually up to now over 500 new units that are kind of moving forward in the process of being developed. And that's enormous, and that's really exciting. And it's all because of this levy that was passed. So we're seeing new affordable housing developers come to the community, which is greatly needed. And we're also seeing developers focus on diverse populations, such as seniors, and youth, both of whom definitely could use more affordable housing. So a few things that the PHAC can do directly. I mentioned that affordable housing funding for jurisdictions to save some of their sales tax. There will be opportunities for advocacy there to pay attention to when it comes to the Clark County councilors, as well as if you live in Washougal or the City of Vancouver. There's an advocacy opportunity there if you're interested. There's always opportunities within the county to advocate for additional dollars to serve people experiencing homelessness. in proportion to other like-sized cities, like Spokane, for example, we have far fewer dollars that support our homeless crisis response system. And it's that we don't have general fund dollars through the county level. And so that's definitely an opportunity, though I'm not quite sure when that will be realistic. The reality is that we have a very robust homeless crisis response system. And so as you're thinking, if you're working with anyone that is thinking about a pilot project or thinking about a way to help address gaps in the homeless system, my ask is to encourage them to check in with a representative from the Council for the Homeless or someone that's very familiar with the crisis response system and make sure that it has a place within the system. And what that does is that increases the efficiencies, it also increases the access, and it helps to make sure that everyone is aware of what's going on. And that's a key piece to making sure that we're making a difference, is making sure that there's that systemic response. If you heard anything that you felt like debunked a stereotype or myth, I ask you to share it with folks, to help me share that message of what is realistic based on the data and the information that we have versus what is just an assumption or a myth that people simply believe or that might be informed by one personal experience. One of the most effective ways we're going to address homelessness is if we can help break down those stereotypes and myths. When we talk to people who are experiencing homelessness and ask them, what is the number one thing we can ask the community to do? They share, listen, one. If you have the time and you're interested in just sitting down saying, hey, people experiencing homelessness have some of the most motivating and inspiring stories that I've ever heard in my life, and are the most resilient people I've ever met. So if you have an opportunity to listen to their story, I encourage you to, as well as just simply be kind. I was driving to work 2 days ago, and there's someone that I knew who is without a home right now, and someone chucked a 7-Eleven can of Coke at him. Mm. And I just thought, who does that? But that's the reality for people who are experiencing homelessness. Unfortunately, there is a lens among very few people, but some, that they are less than. And the fact is we encourage all to remember that these are people, just like all of us, that they deserve the respect and the kindness that everyone does, and that they so rarely get. So I appreciate anything that you can do. There's many other ways to get involved regarding advocacy. The Council for the Homeless has an advocacy newsletter that we encourage you to go to our website and sign up. Donating to any agency, of course, is very effective. Hygiene kits that meet the basic needs of folks are always needed by all agencies, and it helps people just meet their basic needs. If you have a room that you might be interested in talking to an agency about renting, that would be something I'd be interested in hearing about. Feel free to email me or give me a call. Our winter shelters and our overnight shelters are always looking for volunteers, so that could also be an option. And then I know that many of you are already very involved in the community, so thank you for everything that you do to help make Clark County a good place to live for everyone. Thank you. Any questions? I probably don't have time.
No, you do. That's awesome. Bob, did you have a question?
I have one question. The four churches that have housing when the weather's bad, where are they located?
Sure. So we have Living Hope, that's off of Andreessen. The Lord's Gym, which is off of Fourth Plain by the Day Center. Emmanuel Lutheran, which is off of MacArthur, and then Beautiful Savior, which is off of East of 205. And then we just had a church in Amboy who said that they're interested, so that would kind of be your neighborhood.
Well, I like that, but it really kind of just, I don't know if you're familiar with the Boise decision to camping in parks. they really just disservice by not allowing us to use churches to access resources that you can't send people to churches because of their religious, if they're doing religious outreach and stuff. But in a way that, especially for our communities, a lot of the resources are religious-based, you know, so.
Yeah, you know, the key there is whether there's proselytizing occurring, but but sure, that makes sense, especially in, you know, Boise, that was a reality.
Kate, tell them about the series that's going on this summer.
Sure. So I had provided this list to Lydia, and she'll send it out, but in an effort to continue to inform the community about the great work that's happening, we are providing what we're calling a best practice basics training. And so every month for the rest of the year, we're providing a training around a particular topic. So the next one is July 20th, and it's at the Vancouver Housing Authority from 5:30 to 7 p.m. And it focuses on coordinated entry, so basically the Housing Solution Center, and why it's a best practice and happening across Washington State. What are more the specific details and who are the partners that we work with. But there's many other trainings and we'll be sure to send it out. Feel free to come, no RSVP, just feel free to show up.
Great. So Kate, you on your homeless management information system, what kind of data are you collecting on folks in that system? And is there a way to, I mean, and how are you utilizing that data to sort of connect people to the, you know, to different resources in the community and with partners to share that in that systemic way?
So the data that we collect is primarily demographic, as well as what services are being provided within the system. And so, for example, when we refer someone to a housing program, we enter that, or if you know, we provide someone with a shower at the day center, that's entered.
Got it. Okay.
So there are kind of minute details, but it's all systemic. Mm-hmm. The challenge that we have regarding like sharing with different systems is that our state is particularly strict in the ways that the data can be shared.
Right.
And lock it down to basically RPA being able to analyze it.
Kate, I've heard you say before in terms of misperceptions, I think the data point is 25% of the homeless actually work in Clark County, is that right?
So the point in time count actually is 40%.
40%.
Yeah, and that's gone up. And thank you for asking, because I like to share that not only do people have a job, but very often they have two or three jobs, mm-hmm. Particularly because in this community it's hard to get a full-time minimum wage job. Many entities, you know, they want to cut you off at 20 or 30 hours, so they don't have to pay benefits.
Yeah.
And so lots of folks have to have money.
I use that talking point a lot, and that really resonates with people.
Yeah. Great.
In terms of the misperception.
Thank you. Yeah.
Kate, you guys used to make this small pocket fold-out with all the information of all the sources. Are you guys still printing those? If you do, can I get a bunch of them from you?
Yeah, you know, we aren't printing. Now it's like up to 8 pages. It is on our website, and feel free. I will also say we have an at-a-glance resource that's in your packet. It's the second to last page, and it's just
that.
A one-page, sure. But the larger one, feel free to print out. But I'd also, if you want to email me, I'm glad to send you a few.
Guys, it was so easy to hand them out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anything else?
Do you have a way of triaging, like, who gets housing, or is it first come, first serve basis? How does that?
That's a great question, and actually, triaging is a great way to illustrate what it is that we do, because we place people in the programs that serve those with the highest needs. And so we actually have an evidence-based assessment called the VI-SPADAT, which is based in a company in Canada that created it. And it basically asks questions around what are the barriers that you are facing related to housing. And so the more barriers, the higher score you get. And that determines what type of program you get into. And there are folks who have very few barriers and are likely to resolve their homelessness on their own that are not eligible for housing programs. Marla?
This was really a great presentation, very thorough, and just so much great information. I know that the Council for the Homeless is working on a campaign to bolster and be able to have more effectiveness through the Housing Solution Center, get it even more robust. And the thing that I think is exciting about that is because if that effort is more successful, then that ultimately can free up resources for the folks that are experiencing homelessness because of chronic conditions and other situations that are much harder to unravel and address. Am I saying that right? So
you are, yes. Mm-hmm.
So I'm just putting that out there so that people can be aware of it, and I think there's information on the website about it if folks are interested in knowing more about that or see that as an opportunity to provide some support. I just wanted to let folks know that that's going on right now, and it's a great opportunity to partner and come alongside of the Council for the Homeless and help do something that will have a definite and pretty immediate effect.
Thank you so much for mentioning that. And it's our Housing Relief Fund is the campaign that we're doing right now. And as Marla so eloquently shared, we're working to fill in the gaps. You know, we recognize that people aren't going to save enough money to be able to move into their own housing, mm-hmm. and that governmental dollars are going to focus on those with the highest need. And so we have been privately fundraising to address that gap and to help people end their homelessness when they have the resources to sustain housing. So feel free to email me if you'd like more information, and it is on the website.
Okay, talk about how the Housing Solution Center, how the Housing Relief Fund got started. Maybe some people may not be aware of that, what happened.
Sure. So now, almost 4 years ago, there was an apartment complex called Courtyard Village, which actually was just a kitty corner to where we are. And in December, very close to Christmas, the complex was sold and bought by an out-of-state conglomerate. And they decided that they were going to basically flip the property and rehab all the units. And they were doing it in kind of a successive series. But what it meant is that the majority of the tenants would need to leave by the end of December, you know, Christmas on the 25th, the end of December, and find a new unit. And this particular complex had been very affordable prior to this new owner. And so the families living there were primarily from one elementary school and very low income. And so what was amazing is that the Family Community Resource Centers through the Vancouver School District, the Vancouver Housing Authority, FISH, the Council for the Homeless, and other entities got together and said, this isn't right. We need to be able to help these families move into new housing. And so with advocacy, they were able to push the move out date by at least a month so they weren't bombarded by the Christmas time. And also start the Housing Relief Fund to help these families move into a new unit and have financial assistance to do so. And so it's really an inspiring start to a great fund. And a great example of the community coming together around something that unfortunately really does continue to happen in our community and beyond.
Okay. What are some of the, you had mentioned on a slide that there are a fair amount of private efforts going on as well. Can you give some examples of what some of those efforts are? And are those listed on your website as well?
You know, not on the website. Mm-hmm. A few things that are happening is there's a veteran village that received some City of Vancouver Affordable Housing Fund, but is being primarily privately funded.
Okay.
And there was a great Columbian article on it just recently that I'm sure you can Google. Mm-hmm. There's another entity called Community Roots Collaborative, and they're also working on creating the cottage homes mm-hmm. That people moving out of homelessness can live in. And they have a website that you can connect to. There's also the Day Center, which is newly opened from last November, that Share runs. They have a private funder that helps to support the laundry that's there. And I mean, the fact is laundry is incredibly important. And so without that, people wouldn't have an opportunity to be able to wash their clothes. There's also a mobile shower unit through an agency called Food with Friends. And they are, on Fridays, they're at Friends of the Carpenter. On Saturday and Sundays, they're at Living Hope Church. And they provide almost 100 showers a week to people. And the fact is that unless you go to the day center, the mobile shower, or there's a shower in the Washougal Salvation Army, there aren't any others that are available to people experiencing homelessness. And so it means it's very difficult to be clean, even if you want to be. So having that day center open was incredible, and we need more resources. The Salvation Army is actually creating a family resource center right now. They're building it on their property out east, and that'll be exciting to give families a place to be able to shower. So just a few, sure. Anything else? Well, please feel free to email me if you have any more questions. I recognize this was a lot of information, so I'm glad to sit down with you two and share a few more of the details. But ultimately, thank you for everything that you do. Public health goes hand in hand with addressing homelessness, and you do important work. So thank you for everything.
Thank you. Okay, that was really informative. Thank you. That was a lot of talking. You did a really nice job. So we are going to have a budget update and some department updates. And Jeff and Ellen are planning on doing a brief update on foundational public health, I think.
Foundational public health. We had a work session with the Clark County Councilors last Wednesday to discuss our environmental public health fee schedule. They landed on a preferred option moving forward. It gives us guidance on how to prepare our 2020 budget submission. As of right now, with our draft budget, we do have a balanced budget for 2020 without any reduction in expenses. We're going to be able to return about $140,000 a year to the general fund without losing services. So we're taking some pressure off the general fund, like some other departments are as well. The next step is we'll receive our baseline budget next Monday, July 1st. All of our decision packages, our balanced budget is due August 5th. And then in October, there'll be work sessions, and the county manager's budget will be published. And anyway, legally, the counselors need to adopt a balanced budget the first full week of December. So, a lot to do between now and then, but right now it's looking really fairly good. We're not growing, but we're not shrinking either, which is nice.
So I'll give you the latest update on foundational public health services. And if you recall, a session ago, the state gave public health $11 million for the biennium. And now, more recently, I think I've brought this to you before, we done a big assessment. We needed to close the gaps in foundational public health services. We needed about 400 and something million. We asked for 100, we got 22. The good news about that is the $22 million is, for the biennium is ongoing. Now I'm gonna give you, and I'll try to be, if you want some detail, I'll try to give you a little detail, but not too much detail. So the state authorized up to $22 million for foundational public health services in the next biennium. $10 million of that is coming out of the state general fund, but the other $12 million is coming out of the vape tax that was passed. So the vaping products tax. The vaping tax revenues are to be split, according to the legislature, 50-50 between foundational public health services and the Andy Hill Cancer Research Endowment. The projections for the vapor tax, for the vape tax, are 17.2 million. And that has to be split 50-50 with this cancer research endowment fund. So basically, there's $8.6 million out of the vape tax that will come to public health. And you add that to the $10 million out of the general fund. So instead of 22 million, we're now down to 18.6. I don't know how much detail you want, but I'm going to cut to the chase pretty quickly. But out of that...
Is the vaping tax increasing or decreasing?
I think over time it will increase. But for the next biennium, it's 18.6. So, I'm sorry, it's for the next biennium, it is 17.2. We get 8.6 out of that. You add that to the 10 million of the state general fund, we get 18.6. Mm-hmm. Hopefully that in future by any other vape tax will be enough that we'll get the full 22 million. But for the next 2 years, it's 18.6. Of that, $3 million is allocated to Seattle, King County. They got $3 million last time and it's gonna continue. So that gets us down to 15, okay? From 18, well, 15.6. $2 million is going to the Department of Health and the State Board of Health. $1 million is going to some innovative pilot projects, none of which affects Clark County, but another $1 million is going to continue to go to those. And I'm not going to give you the details on those. $1.2 million is going to go to the tribes for foundational public health services. And $100,000 is going to go to this additional to the State Board of Health. That gets us up to about 16 million. Instead of giving you all this detail, let me just cut to the chase. There's going to be $9 million available for local public health jurisdictions, which is basically the same amount that we got in the last biennium. So we're not looking at any increased funding for foundational public health services coming to Clark County Public Health, at least for the next biennium. And I can give you all the details and all the numbers.
So should we advocate for increased vaping?
It's crazy.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm just giving you the news. And I could give you the other breakdowns here, but we're not looking at increase. Jeff, was there about $9 million that went to the local health jurisdictions last time? Yeah. And so we'll be after all this other stuff. So hopefully in the future by any, but I got to tell you that even if we were able to get more funding out of the vape tax, a lot of that is already promised to other areas. So if there's an additional 2.3 million that comes out of that, or 3.4 million, it's already being devoted to other things that does not come to local health jurisdictions. And I could give you a rundown on that, but even if we got up to 22 million, I don't have any evidence that we're going to get any additional funding for Clark County Public Health. Or
the irony of that is we'll use some of the money that we collectively, public health, will be using some of that money to talk about some of the dangers of vaping, which is where we get, I mean, it's just, that's...
Mm-hmm. Well, the other thing about this is that you all, a lot of you advocated for foundational public health services. Mm-hmm. Our counselors, our board of health, were up in Olympia advocating for public health. If you recall, for the past 2 years, we were involved in that assessment that took an incredible amount of staff time to figure out where the gaps are. We put a lot of work into this. And I mean, it's great that there's some more money for public health across the state, but it's really not hitting all the jurisdictions equally. So the other good news is that, well, we're getting the same amount, but at least it's ongoing. Mm-hmm. So we don't have to advocate for it each time, but that's basically the bottom line.
How much do we actually get?
I think we got about 250,000, 259 a year. 259,570 a year, so, you know, 500 and whatever, do the NAT, 519 biennium.
And just to keep it in perspective, the measles response was about $700,000. So
it was 864,000, of which Right.
Correct.
$80,000 was paid for out of grants.
Exactly.
Correct.
Exactly. But so to keep it in perspective, this is just an example of how public health is just chronically underfunded. And it's very challenging to, when we have situations like that, to, you know, our staff members were pulled, as Alan had mentioned before, from all different areas, and we have to focus on this. And so everything else in the public health system is impacted.
The other thing, the other irony about this is, a few years ago, when we were first advocating for foundational public health services, Councilor Olson and I went to the Columbian, and we gave them examples of where we were underfunded. And one of them was is our ability and our resources to get immunization rates up. And we predicted that there'd be some sort of outbreak, which we had. And part of the challenge around, you know, we spent all that money on measles, but part of the challenge down the road is just getting resources both for public health and the schools to help get immunization rates on, because there's a lot of problem with the data systems and schools getting access to that. And even the amount of outreach work that it, to get the compliance rates up in schools takes a lot of resources. But, you know, this is inevitable. Those are, you know, getting immunization rates up is a foundational public health service, but we don't have the additional funding to do that. So something we'll just need to keep on advocating. I think the door is open with the legislature in subsequent sessions, because our original ask, what we were willing to settle for is $100 million. We got 22, but I think we need to keep pushing over the next, you know, the next session or the next whatever session comes up to get additional funding.
You know, today Dr. Melnick was there's a monthly webinar that comes out of the Northwest Center for Public Health Practice at the University of Washington, and he was the speaker today on the measles epidemic here in Clark County and the immunizations. And he had some nice slides, that one where it shows the rates of immunization in the schools. It's just shocking. It's really about, you know, when is the next outbreak going to come, because we have to, you know, and there was a spike in immunizations during the time of the outbreak, but then it's gotten back down to normal. And that's where we really need to get those immunization rates up so we have herd immunity. But it would be interesting if we could share that PowerPoint slide with the council, especially with that one graph.
Yeah, we could, to bring it, yeah, we can bring that information.
I spoke
to the to FAC before about, yeah, we can get that.
Yeah, but that one slide in particular.
Yeah, it's really, you know, having an outbreak is a lousy way to get immunizations up. Because it doesn't last.
It doesn't last.
Yeah, people get, but I'm optimistic that that statute that we got passed remove the philosophic exemption for MMR will help. But yeah, it's a lousy way to get people immunized. Anyway, speaking of foundational public health services.
So I want to give you guys a quick update of some things happening in environmental public health. This is stuff that you may have heard in the media or will be coming up in the media. The first thing I wanted to share with you is in our water protection program. So Public Works has been working on a pilot where they're testing water from Whipple Creek. Through that testing, they were trying to determine if the contamination was human or animal. And it did come back as human contamination. And so the next step for our programs is to look at the properties along Whipple Creek that are not in compliance with their septic system inspections. Right now, there's no human exposure along that creek, so we have time to work on this. We're going to reach out to those properties. We're going to notify them they're out of compliance on inspections, give them education, explain to them why it's important, and now we have some data to share with people so they can understand the impact. However, we anticipate we probably won't get 100% compliance. There may be a time where we will come to the council and propose that we levy fines against properties that do not get their systems inspected. That is not something we've done in the past, and not sure we will. It'll be some old conversation we'll have to have with council, but I wanted to give you guys a heads up that that could happen at some point. Did
Yeah. So if you can identify, I don't know if you're able to tell this, but like which property is responsible. Okay, so that makes it harder, but it seems like if there is harm being caused to the water system because of this, that it could be more than fines. It might be something that just says you may no longer use your system until it meets the expectations or the requirements. Is that that might sound drastic, but if nothing's done, or even if fines are levied and they pay them, but it doesn't change the problem, then is there something that would be a little bit more aggressive in terms of being able to fix it?
Possibly. I think one of the things that's really exciting about this project is that we have historically, I think, had a lot of pushback from our policymakers and the public about septic system inspections, because it's my system, why are you telling me what to do? And I think we have now some really good data and evidence that can support why it is so important that people keep up on their septic inspections. So I'm hoping that we will be able to levy this into higher, and we actually, for our county, we have high compliance rates compared to some other counties. But I'm hoping this will be an opportunity for us to have those conversations and have a little bit more support from our policymakers.
I'd be interested in reading the study. A lot of times you can have contamination in it. And if you see where the samples are taken at, you kind of identify where the problem areas are. Plus, you'd be surprised if you find one or two, three, four, which is a great number, but take care of those problems, what it can do to the water quality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and we just met with Public Works about 2 weeks ago, and they showed us a map where they did the testing where the properties are. There's a lot of wells and septic systems out in that area, in certain areas. I think we just got the report. Dr. Melnick has gotten a copy. I haven't gotten, had the privilege to see the report yet. But yeah, we'll be sharing and looking at, can we at least limit, we want to educate everybody that's in that area, because right now, as you know, Mark, there's so many systems in the county that we don't even know about, right? Because they, people build them themselves or whatever. But I think this will be an opportunity for us to get that more support to identify more of those systems and really show what the impact is.
Yeah, and a lot of them get down going from door to door, basically doing a sanitary survey.
Yep.
And kind of pinpoint the ones that are in poor soils or the ones that may be having discharge and you can't see through the black areas or that sort of thing. The other thing on maintenance, our maintenance program is really good.
Yeah.
But we got to be very, very careful not to get bad publicity, because it could change.
Yeah.
There's been other jurisdictions, you can't believe the numbers of people that have packed public hearings and counties. The state rules say you've got to have maintenance. But it's anywhere from you notify the people they should take care of it, or having a good active maintenance program out here. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
so very political.
It is very political. And I was at our environmental health director's meeting a couple weeks ago, and really Clark County is one of the few counties that actually has an operations and maintenance program. And we are held up as an example, and many other counties would like to do this. They just can't get the political support to move it forward. So, yeah, I agree.
The fact that there are wells in the area raises some concerns. You know, we've got discharge to ground into surface water here, but you wonder, you know, given the concentration or how many failing systems there are, whether there's a risk to the groundwater as well. I don't know, but people do have wells in that area.
When you talk about sending the letters out to the people that have or checking inspections, those are just the permitted systems, right?
Yes.
I mean, so is there a mechanism to survey for unpermitted? Or?
No, there, anybody that has, if they're in an area that is no sewers there, they're given notification.
Right.
We did a robust septic reconciliation program several years ago. We found 33,000 tax parcels in the county that we showed no record of being on sewer or septic. And that was down.
3,000?
Yeah, it was a very, 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 now, that was narrowed down when we look at the taxable value of the lots. So some of them were what is vacant lots. But we actually found some lots that were on city sewer back to the 80s and the city had no idea.
But you got a lot of housing. Really, people weren't getting septic permits till the 1970s, so pretty much anything prior to that was somebody did get a first sewage ordinance in Clark County was 1959, and between 59 and say 70 or so, it's if it was the FHA, VA, they maybe got a permit if they didn't.
We may have gotten away with it this long because there wasn't as much density.
Well, I think a lot of it is site selections. If you get a good site, good soil conditions, the proper type of system water, it's going to protect groundwater. But you got a lot of systems that were, say, in Murfreesboro Creek, where you got a high water table.
Yeah.
That doesn't do well for the groundwater.
Yeah. If you keep it out of the winter water table, that's what you want. Yeah.
Okay, so next update, food safety. Animals in food establishments, always a controversial topic. So we are approaching, we get a lot of complaints on both sides of the fence about this, and so we're addressing it with a two-pronged approach. The first is, I believe we've talked to you about before, is doing a little more education with our food establishments about what you can and cannot do when people bring animals into your establishment. What questions you can ask, what questions you can't ask. And, you know, what is a service animal? It has to be a dog or a miniature horse. There are a lot of limitations. The animals have to be well behaved. You could have a service animal, and if it's not behaving appropriately, you can ask them to leave. So we're doing a lot of education and outreach to our food establishments about what they can and cannot do with their animals. The second thing we're doing this summer, which is very exciting, is our food safety manager is working with food establishments that have outdoor patios to allow dogs on patios. The cool thing about this is a lot of people want it. A lot of food establishments are already doing it. But this gives us a way to get a foot in the door and educate them about what we will allow in terms of, for example, you can't bring your dogs through the food establishment to the patio. You have to have access from the outside. You know, you can't have them, the animals, dogs drinking out of the same bowls that you're gonna use to serve people. You can't have the dog on your lap. There's all these kinds of things, signage that we're working with and there, but it does take time. It's taking time to educate. We're giving them examples of signs. We're doing all kinds of work. So we are charging a fee, a variance fee. But this is going to give a lot of our food establishments that have patios an opportunity to have dogs. Now, we have some facilities that are, or food establishments that are not happy about paying a variance fee. So we're people, we had one food establishment, I think it was yesterday or today, post that we're ruining their fundraiser because we won't allow dogs on their patio or we're making them pay too much money. So
it was a Facebook post, right, on their Facebook page? Or was
it Facebook? Actually is on their webpage.
How much is the
so what's a typical variance fee for?
$300 for the dogs on the patio.
So, and that fee includes the ability, the education and the ability for them to have legally or technically county, under county code to be able to have their dogs on the patio.
Yeah. And this is a trend of the...
Is that a one-time fee or they pay yearly?
I'm not sure. That's a good question. Is it one time?
I've heard that's not yearly.
It's one time
fee.
And the state
we
code
should
is
increase it so that we could have some more public health funding.
Yeah,
it's very cheap for a one time only. Mm-hmm.
But you bring in the thing of animals, and people are more likely to start giving you some money.
Hypothetically, if you know a lady that has a stroller and puts her dog in the stroller and puts it in the runs into the restaurant out to the patio, and everybody thinks it's a baby. And when they ask to look at it, she always says that the baby's sleeping right now. I won't diamond her off. I live with her, but.
I have a stroller for my dog, so I can't call
it. You use the restaurants.
Yeah.
You do?
No, I don't. Only the patio. He's cranky, so. But so there has been a lot of activity on Facebook. There's a lot of web pages talking about this. We're talking to the counselors. We're letting people know. But just wanted to give you guys a heads up that that is a variance we're working on.
Janice, what are the three questions that an establishment can ask? I can never remember.
Two questions.
Oh, two questions.
Yes, they can ask, is the service animal required because of a disability?
Okay.
And what task is the animal trained to perform?
Okay.
You can't ask what the disability is, you cannot ask to witness a task, and you cannot request documentation.
Gotcha.
Thank you. But, it does not include comfort, emotional support, therapy, or guard animals. So dogs are manger horses, and for the patios, it's only dogs.
But they don't have to prove that it's a service animal. I mean, there's no proof that it's a service animal. It's just whether they say it is
or not. I have a client that I still, her dog's very well behaved, and she goes all sorts of places with a service animal, and I don't have to sign for her. But I have to do a lot of documentation for her because she takes her dog internationally, and I don't still to this day know if I've been trying to find out what her disability is. No. And she will say, you know, the two questions I've asked is, yes, it's a disability, and it alerts me. And that's all I get. And I don't know, and that's, I mean, I'm like afraid to ask anymore. Very nice person, good dog. I mean, everything's healthy, they're good clients. But that's probably it, huh? It just alerts me. That's legit.
Well, and I think therein lies the problem with getting, you know, how would you, if you even put together a certification program, what would that look like? Because if these animals have to be trained to a certain thing they do for your whatever disability it is, how would you actually build a certification program to capture the breadth of what that might be? So that's been a big challenge, is how do you really certify this, and what do we do? So I think that's still ongoing dialogue, I'm imagining.
They have to be trained.
Yeah.
It has to fit the training category, but you could train the dog yourself. So there's, but you know, you can buy a vest anywhere that says service animal, so that's one of the reasons they don't require that anymore.
Most of the dogs encountered are very well trained.
Yes.
You can usually tell because you never even know they're there. Mm-hmm.
And that's, it's very unusual for a trained service animal to be misbehaving.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We had renters that, husband and wife, that were profoundly deaf. And so we had a service animal which we completely felt was appropriate. I mean, if anybody would need a service animal, it would be this family because they had a baby too. But the dog was not under their control most of the time. It was not; they were not cleaning up after them. So there were issues about it, and we never asked them, you know, what task was the dog trained to do, because it was so non-compliant in other ways. Mm-hmm. But we just looked the other way because we knew that they probably really needed it. That's where I get frustrated, because people can kind of create a network of rules for themselves that are not consistent or compliant with what the regulation is for. And it's such an important, good thing to allow service animals that I sometimes worry that because of all of the loosey-goosey handling of how it works, that there could be some loss of opportunity to maintain service animal provisions.
Yeah. And I'm sure if you go anywhere in Clark County, you notice there's really been an increase in. It's hard to go any place and not see at least one animal inside the facility.
I think the signage, though, I've noticed a lot. Southern Ridgefield has been much better and very professional and out, and I think it's been really, I think you guys
Well, there's a new law out, and I can't remember the number. It was implemented in January that basically says that it's a misdemeanor to falsify or present your animal as a service animal if it is not indeed a service animal. I'm sure hard to enforce, but it has, we've been able to update some signage and provide, and it has, in other counties where they've measured this, they have seen a reduction in animals being brought into the facility.
That would be a real interesting court case, you know, you just think about, with all these limitations for the law, how would you even cite somebody for a misdemeanor, you know, it's just,
interesting. So in the training that they get about what questions they can ask and what they can do, is there also training for the restaurant owners about how you would dismiss the dog if it's not following those things or whatever, so.
Well, they can give them some guidance. It really is up to the food establishment owner to manage it.
Right.
One of the places we frequently get complaints is at Fredmeyer, but you know, the management keeps telling their staff, tell people that bring in their animals, they can't have them in here, and the staff are like, we don't want to do it. So it's a very complex issue. And we don't do enforcement. I mean, if we go to a facility or a food establishment for an inspection and we see they have dogs in the, you know, dining area, we would work with them on that. But most of the time, this is not happening. I mean, they can't call us and say, hey, there's dogs. They could, but.
I just think guidance is part of that training, helps them know how to manage the situation, that, you know, if there is an issue there, you know, what can they do, and what are their limits?
When is this variance going to start taking place?
It's already happened, so what really launched this is Heathen Brewery was having a fundraiser for the Southwest Washington Humane Society, and they were going to have a yappy hour, and we found out about it, and said, you know, that you can't do this. This is against state law. But then, you know, our food safety manager figured the last thing she wanted to see on the cover of the Columbian was public health hates animals.
Yeah.
So she started doing some research. How are other jurisdictions handling this? What are some guidelines and rules we can, that makes this acceptable to us? And she really launched it pretty quickly, and they were able to apply for a variance. I think it was 2 days before the event.
And so are the areas that have that variance able to publicize that they are legally to do this? You will not get a misdemeanor, or well, the people wouldn't necessarily. Would the people get fined if they were in the patio, or would the dining facility get fined?
It would be
if anybody was to get fined at all. But
it would be the owner of the food establishment.
The food establishment would have the consequences of allowing people with pets on their patio.
Yes, if they were doing it inappropriately.
But the misdemeanor would be against
a service animal,
a person who is misrepresenting.
That has something to do with us.
Right.
We don't enforce.
Right.
Right. Okay.
Service animal laws.
Are there places? Is there like a thing that you can say? You know. Animals are welcome, you know,
I believe someone told me yesterday Heathen Brewery has a sign up that says dogs welcome on patio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it might be nice for the county to have something that like a benefit for the very, you know, people with the public would see, like, oh, well, they've done some training, you know, people who don't necessarily want dogs on the patio might see this and say, okay, well, they've gone through some training, they understand that
they have to have signs.
Yeah.
They have to have signs, but we're still rolling it out.
Yeah.
And I can tell you, I heard yesterday we got 14 complaints, about half on each side, so
Marissa is working on a media release that's going to go out, or a press release that's going to go out in the morning.
So we're still ramping up, but it's pretty.
Well, yeah, if you head in the summer, people get all sorts
So Jennifer, you said you have half and half. People complaining about dogs being on the patio, and then others complaining that they can't have their dogs on the patio.
Oh, and then a few of those were complaining because they didn't want to pay variance. So,
okay.
Yeah, we're getting in.
The biggest issue I have is the miniature horses. They're not as well trained.
They can be. They're service.
They could be in the restaurant,
but not in if they're a service. Right. They could be in the restaurant.
They could be in a restaurant. Yes. Exactly.
I've never seen a miniature horse servicing in a book. I was kind of
like, what kind of training is this? I mean, they're horses. I'd rather have one of those goats.
So, I also want to introduce.
As long as you're not horsing around.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, we're running out of time. So, I also want to introduce Brian Schlottman. He's our new program manager. He oversees rec water, school health and safety,
pollution prevention, site hazard assessment, and solid waste enforcement.
He passed.
You sure heard him on
here.
OPB this morning.
He's gonna give a couple quick updates also.
Sorry. I'll make it quick. Summer's here. We've already seen three algae blooms, in one in Vancouver Lake, one in Lackamas Lake, and one in Round Lake. little history. Our first bloom last year didn't happen until July 20th. Our first bloom this year was June 12th. You'll see caution signs up. So if you see a caution sign, that means we've identified a bloom. If you see a warning sign, that means we've drawn one sample that's above the beach action value, toxic level, which is an area that probably isn't frequented by swimmers. If you see a closed sign, that means that spot's either had two or more elevated toxic levels, or it's an area that's one test above, or it's frequented by swimmers quite often. We just want to keep people out of that area.
Is so. That blue-green algae?
Blue-green algae. So if you see algae, you don't necessarily know it's dangerous or not. That's why we sample it. And it takes
do signs say keep animals out of it?
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they do. Okay. That's a concern because animals tend to drink the water.
I was involved in a blue-green algae in Spokane years and years ago. And the first way we got wind of it was dogs dying. Yeah.
We had a dog die in Langhus Lake. Mm-hmm. It was a couple of years ago during a bloom. So we've had dog death here.
I had to dig up dog bodies to get stomach contents.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Wow. Wow.
So if you see water that looks like it has algae growing, use an abundance of caution. It's Alan's term. And just avoid the water, avoid water contact.
Well, the toxins can be negative one moment, and then the bloom can make them pretty quickly, so that's...
Yeah, and it takes 72 hours for us to get the results, so that's why we post signs right away when we see it. But again, it can fluctuate based on the weather. school health and safety. Back in May, one of our staff responded to a mold complaint. While they're there, they noticed that there's a risk for potentially a lead hazard. So the school went ahead and had it tested. This is Houck Elementary. I have to draw a picture for this, but EPA, their current threshold right now is 250 micrograms for windowsills, 40 micrograms for floors. Last week, they said that they would start adopting the HUD standards, which is more stringent, at 100 micrograms for windows and 10 micrograms for floors. That won't go into effect for another 6 months, so the beginning of 2020. The levels tested high for the HUD standards on two of the windowsills, high for the EPA standards for one of the classroom floors. We worked with the school, the Vancouver School District, the whole time. None of these classrooms were kids six and under, and they went through with a certified RRP company, cleaned the entire school, and they're working with us. They're going to continue monitoring, continue cleaning throughout the year. And in summer of 2020, they have a capital project coming through that they'll replace all the windows in the entire school and upgrade the HVAC system. So we're confident that the risk to the students is pretty low at this point.
There's been a couple of articles in the Columbian about that also.
Yeah, the school was built in 1941. Got all the way to paint. Yeah.
Melissa, do you want to do a quick update on wildfire stuff?
Sure. So we've been working internally to kind of prepare for wildfire season, and over the last 8 months I've been working with a statewide work group that's addressing wildfire smoke and trying to have consistent coordinated messaging around wildfire smoke and the impacts to health and what people should do to protect themselves, and then also looking at recommendations for closures or cancellations of public events, because historically across the state everyone's kind of done their own thing, and jurisdictions really realize the need for coordinated messaging. So we're going to be kind of rolling out some different things over the next few weeks and going through wildfire season, including creating a web page on our site that's dedicated to wildfire smoke, news releases and social media posts, and working with our school health and safety team to come up with documents specific to schools that provides guidance and recommendations for them. And then we will be presenting to the Board of Health tomorrow morning about this work and partnering with Southwest Clean Air Agency and kind of the work they do and how we're working together through wildfire season.
Okay, last but not least, Recycled Arts Festival is this weekend. Please come. It's going to be at Esther Short Park, Saturday it's 9 to 5, Sunday it's 9 to 4. They're going to do the procession of the species again this year. That's on Sunday at 11 a.m., costume contest afterwards. Brian handed out the Natural Garden Tour maps. That is on July 14th. That is a Sunday, and it is 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Any other questions?
If you haven't been to the Recycled Arts Festival, it is the best festival of all.
It is awesome.
It's fabulous. And it's free. It's just, it's incredible.
It's free till you get there and then you want to buy it.
Oh, and just walking through and just the creativity. I mean, it's like, my goodness. It's just, really cool. It's overwhelming. I just love it.
Yeah. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Okay. All right. Yeah, so moving on to the executive committee, our meeting schedule, we will not have a meeting in July. Our next meeting will be in August. It looks like our November meeting falls on Thanksgiving week, which might be a not so much attended night. Thanksgiving is usually, do we know what day?
It's on Thursday.
We had a November-December meeting, like the early part of December, something like that.
Yeah, we did. So
December, we're dark in December as well. Yeah. We could not do the December meeting and then have an early December meeting that's truly, like, kind of combines those two.
Yeah.
People are open to that. I mean,
The budget hearing is Tuesday, December 4th.
Oh.
So the 11th would be the first time Alan and I could attend.
November 11th would be great because is that what you're saying?
December.
December 11th, okay.
That's a Wednesday, though.
Okay.
Oh, December 10th.
10th, okay.
December 10th.
Well,
it's a budget thing on Tuesday.
It's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, all 3 days.
Is it beneficial to meet with the council prior to that budget hearing in early December?
We'll know later.
Okay.
As of right now, no.
Okay. So we may plan it earlier in November.
That's what we did last year.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember waiting on it.
Would you prefer we just pick a date, or would you prefer we send a doodle poll? What would you guys prefer?
Pick a date.
Okay. Okay, we'll do that, and we'll send you out a note.
When is the budget meeting, you say?
It's the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 2nd, 3rd, 4th.
Would it be good to review that? Would it be better to be before or after, do you think, in general?
At that point, it won't matter.
It doesn't matter either way.
If we have problems with the budget, you'll hear about it well before that.
Okay.
Okay. So we'll work with the executive committee to pick a date, and we'll shoot you all a note. All right.
Are there any council member updates?
I have one update. I know I'm not a council member, but I do have one update. So there's a few folks that are on. Their terms will be up in September, and we will be sending out a note to you. I will be sending you an email to see if you are interested in continuing, and I will be pleading with you all to continue your service to us. So anyway, we have a few people. I think we have like 6 folks that are on the list, so you'll be getting a note from me here in the next week or so.
Okay. I have an announcement, just one. I'm really excited that, I think I've talked about this before, but the Housing Authority, we are opening up Caples Terrace up in Skyline Crest. First time ever we will have its housing for kids aging out of foster care and homeless youth. Fabulous program. It'll be about 28 units, and it'll be right next to Bridgeview. Program manager has really been involved talking with teams, having focus groups about what they need. And the interesting thing is that the location that we picked was not picked because of the feedback, but in fact, when Hillary Prepola, our program managers, had the focus groups with the teens, it exactly meets what their desires are to be in a neighborhood of people who are doing well and, you know, mixed ages, etc. So there will be press coverage about the opening of that, and referrals to get into the unit are handled through a lot of the different partners that work with the foster youth, you know, Janice. And so it's right now there's people, if they would like to donate furniture, you know, because we didn't get institutional furniture for the kids, hoping that they can use this as a way to begin to set up their own household, you know. So there's no time limit on how long they can be there. It'll be, you know, when they feel like they're ready to move on. But it's pretty exciting that because right now kids age out of foster care, they're on their own, and many of them have had no life skills whatsoever to manage money or manage a household.
What's the name of that again? What's the name of that again?
It's Caples Terrace.
Caples,
C-A-P-L-E-S.
Oh, yes.
Caples. It's Caples. Named after the first director of the Housing Authority. Really incredible man.
Caples Street.
Mm-hmm. But there will be an open house, and there'll be some tours and things over time.
Anybody else? All right. 5 o'clock.
Wow. Very good.